Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, C.A. A book that was missing several key chapters could hardly be said to contain the complete story. Our understanding of American feminism may be something like that incomplete book. Thinking of this movement as springing full-blown from the concerns of middle-class professional women in the 1970s leaves out some of the richest chapters in the story. For in the post-war years, working-class women in the labor movement made lasting contributions of their own to the women's movement and raised issues that still deserve society's attention. My guest is Dorothy Sue Cobble, professor in the School of Management and Labor Relations at Rutgers University. Dorothy Sue, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George.
Well, this is a very interesting story, and I thank you very much for introducing me to what I consider now a missing link in our common understanding, or popular understanding at least, of the women's movement in America. And I asked myself, Dorothy Sue, as I read some of the things you've written about this, why it is that it's been so overlooked or ignored or not understood. And a couple of things occurred to me. The first, and let me try this as a question to you, is that perhaps as Americans we are almost tone deaf to notions of class and didn't even recognize that as a major factor in our society at large and in the women's movement in particular. Is that right?
I think that's definitely part of the reason. It's interesting because when the history of the second wave of feminism, or the feminism from the 1960s and 1970s, began to be written, the first group that was given credit for that were middle-class college women. And that story's pretty well known. But actually, people began to understand that African-American women in the civil rights movement also were concerned with issues of equity and ending separatism on the basis of race and sex. And I think in part, their contribution was recognized because American culture is very aware of issues of race. Those are issues that are very salient now in terms in which people think about our society.
Right.
Issues of class, I think, are much more buried.
Right.
And this was not true for the post-war decades. And, you know, what's interesting is that, in fact, we may be seeing a resurgence of those issues of class as economic inequality grows.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think even beyond the women's movement, when we think of economic disparities in our society at large, and, of course, throughout the world, and global divide, looks like class is going to finally, I hope, get the attention it deserves. There's another reason, too, Dorothy Sue, that I thought might be relevant to our story, another reason for why it didn't get the attention it richly deserves, and that is this. Maybe we don't understand, and this is something I got from just thinking about your articles, what political is. In other words, maybe we tend to define it too narrowly. I'm thinking of legislation and you know, particular kind of policy items, but maybe it's a broader meaning to what a political achievement is in terms of a movement.
Right. I think that there's a number of ways in which our definitions of terms get in the way. Sometimes they're conceptual blinders and keep us from really seeing the full range of history. I think political is one term. A lot of women's activities were not defined as political because they were not about voting, for example, even though they're many of the women that I were looking at, some of them actually involved in ladies' auxiliaries, even into the 1960s and 1970s. Their activities were political in the sense that they were trying to promote certain kinds of politically conscious consumer activities, buying clothes that were only made under conditions in which workers were fairly treated, things like that, that often get ignored. I think the other way that, the other term that's very central to my study that I think has been defined way too narrowly is the term feminism. And many of the historians of feminism, I think, see it as a single ideology and define it in the way that middle-class white professional women thought about their needs.
Now, this is extremely interesting, Dorothy Sue. How, then, would you, even in a brief context, what definition of feminism would you prefer? I mean, how do you think that definition should be expanded? How would you rewrite that?
Well, let me tell you how I define it, and then I can tell you how I think it gets defined all too frequently.
Okay.
I think of feminism actually as the recognition that women as a sex suffer inequities, and the commitment to end those inequities regardless of the strategy pursued. And I think one of the things that happened in the 1960s and 70s with the rise of the new feminism, which of course in many ways broke free of all kinds of old notions and was a very liberating movement, but it was also constricting, I think, because it said that in order to be a feminist, you had to, for example, push for the end of the division of labor by sex.
Gender neutrality.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you had to believe that, in I think a very rigid kind of notion of the equality and sameness of men and women, that you had to value wage work over housework. And just to take that one example, for many working class women, clearly work in the home and their identities as mothers and wives gave them much more power and much more status and much more pleasure than wage work in factories or as domestic employees. So there was no reason to define or equate feminism with entry into the wage realm. And I think, you know, Betty Friedan certainly was somebody who promoted this idea of, you know, there was really something wrong with you if you didn't recognize that housework was something to be shunned and could give you no pleasure or fulfillment.
So that definition got much too narrow, too restrictive, and I guess what you're also saying is it tended to almost rule out great numbers of women from, you know, being considered part of the movement or having their contribution recognized.
Right.
You know, one of the things, and I think this is an excellent point, is that a large component of the women that we're talking about, those who did not, you know, view gender inequality as the sole definition of feminism, were in the labor movement. And I thought this was extremely important, militating on the shop floor for lots of things over the years that didn't argue so much on the basis of sameness, but did seek to advance the cause of women within the working environment.
Right.
So that in a sense is a sort of a component of feminism that wasn't recognized or was sort of not given its due as the 1970s definition came in. Is that?
Definitely. One of the ways of thinking about this is that for about a century before the 1970s, for 100 years, one of the primary goals of the women's movement was actually to pass laws that protected women.
In the late 19th century?
Right, from the turn of the century right into the 1960s and 70s. And many of these laws passed on a state basis covered men and women, but were seen as unconstitutional, and so the movement narrowed its goals to just passing sex-based laws. And these provided women with protection against long hours, it raised minimum wages, it gave them health and safety protections, it required bathroom breaks. Mm-hmm. And
was maternity leave a part of this?
You didn't have requirements for specific maternity leaves, but you did have a lot of that developing informally. Mm-hmm. You never really had that legislated. But the women's movement that arose with the National Women's Party after suffrage in 1920s and 1930s began to emphasize a very single focus of gaining legal equality between men and women. And for them, these protective laws then represented women's secondary status. Mm-hmm. And that really divided the women's movement. And so the women who continued to push for protective legislation and to argue that sometimes you need differential treatment in order to achieve equality really became seen as holders of out-of-date, outmoded ideas of women who were not forward-looking and were relics of the past.
Let me make sure I understand that, Dorothy Sue. Are you saying that the schism or difference that sprung up, I guess, from the 30s onward or 20s, 30s and there?
20s onward,
20s
right.
onward. Was between those who were arguing for protection of women as women, given special conditions they might face, versus, was it already a gender equality school that was saying that's not the
campaign? Right. The National Women's Party was primarily promoting the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment,
right.
And that required, the goal of that was equal protection under the law for men and women. And the fear of many women who opposed the ERA was that that constitutional amendment would then make illegal all of the legislation they had fought for 100 years to pass.
Mm-hmm.
And their notion was that these laws should be extended to men rather than to just be wiped off the books.
Right, right. So in their view, and I think quite correctly, they were making major advances in the cause of women. But this kind of orthodoxy about equal rights sort of ruled them out in the eyes of the gender equality feminists. Is that right?
Right. I mean, I think one of the things that seems to be true is that feminist history also gets written so that women who have a single, unwavering focus on gender inequality become the heroines of that history,
mm-hmm.
and that women who may not always see gender inequality as the problem, but also have issues in terms of race or class, these women then are not seen as true feminists. So the National Women's Party, for example, their focus was a single issue. They were uncompromising, and that was their concern. It didn't really matter what the consequences of that were in other arenas.
Another thing that strikes me, Dorothy Sue, is that given your scholarship, we began to correct what is, I think, largely misperceived as a void between suffrage in the 70s. Because when you situate this kind of, I use my word, communitarian feminism growing up within the labor movement on the shop floor in an activist way, you fill in those decades between the 20s and 70s. Because, I mean, I would think you do, or do you? I mean, is there a progressive nature to that?
Absolutely. I think that one of the ways of thinking about the women that I'm looking at is that they were definitely the foremothers of the new feminism,
right.
In the sense that they were raising issues of equality, even though they didn't always agree with the means to equality being integration of the workforce and things like that that arose in the 60s and 70s. They were definitely in agreement with the goals of gender equality. They just took a different route to that.
Right.
You could also, I think of them perhaps as potential foremothers of a third wave of a new 21st century feminism, that they point, I think, the way to the future, in the sense that they are concerned with the interests of the majority of women. They were taking up issues, economic issues that unite women rather than divide them, such as cultural issues. And that they were concerned with class and race, which I think is a way of building a coalition that you really need to make change in this society.
This is something that occurred to me, and it's actually something I want us to come back to in our conversation, because I got a sense, not so much, well, of history, of course, but also of our contemporary world, with a focus on globalization and this rising sense of there are real class issues, there are real divisive issues in terms of genders and ethnic groups and so forth that have to be resolved. So maybe this is a once in future story.
Right.
In a sense.
Right.
Let me take a moment from our conversation, Dorothy Sue, to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Dorothy Sue Cobble, professor in the School of Management and Labor Relations at Rutgers University. Let me ask you this as a scholar. When these chapters are added, when this story is brought back in and put in its place, what do we gain? I mean, what's the real value of completing the picture of 20th century, and I guess 19th and perhaps 21st century feminism with this inclusion?
I think there's a number of things to be gained. One could simply talk about, as E.P. Thompson did, rescuing voices from the condescension of posterity, that these are women who've been ignored and in some way unfairly maligned because they did not always agree with the generation of activists that came to the fore in the 1960s and 70s. I think you also get a much broader sense of the history of the women's movement that allows people to feel a part of that, whereas before they couldn't always identify with that movement because it didn't really recognize or represent their interests.
I would like to focus on that because, to put the matter perhaps very bluntly, and again, I'd really appreciate your reaction to this, I've gotten the impression that there is something of a very strong class schism within, and here let me make a distinction, what's perceived as the women's movement as it is today, and vast numbers of women who will say things, and I think in terms of like welfare rights disputes and inner-city women relating to the various campaigns, say, they're not speaking for me. They're not speaking to me. And working-class women saying that. And that part of that perception, or part of that perception on their part, owed to a belief that, you know, when the women's rights movement would say, you can't fully realize yourself within the family, or that kind of thing, they were really excluding large parts of their experience that they valued. I mean, that it goes beyond just a dissonance, but there is a real schism and perhaps a perception on the part of working class women that their lives and their values were somehow disdained or valued less than the others.
Right. I mean, I think that one thing that's happening just as we speak is actually a number of articles have come out recently in Harper's and other places about domestic employees and the ways in which middle-class women's liberation has been achieved at the expense of a whole class of women who became their maids. Mm-hmm. Now, I actually think that there's nothing to be ashamed of in doing housework, and that the notion that everybody has to do their own housework is sort of a utopian kind of vision. There's nothing wrong with paying people to do housework as long as they're paid well. But those issues of not just advancement for professional women, but advancement economically for the majority of women are the issues that haven't gone away, and they're the very issues that the generation of labor feminists in the 40s and 50s, that was at the core of their movement. Mm-hmm. So they fought for what they called rate for the job, which is something that more middle-class women can understand because it was about being paid for your job performance rather than because you were a man and deserved a family wage. You should have a rate based on your job. But they also fought for upping the minimum wage, extending that to categories of women that had been excluded. Household employees, for example, weren't included under minimum wage legislation until 1972. Mm. So that was very central to their movement. They also, let me just add one other thing in terms of their issues, that for them, what they wanted was to revalue and upgrade women's work and to gain recognition for the jobs that women did and to see those the aspects of that work as skilled. So they raised issues of comparability in jobs and why men who were in unskilled or semi-skilled jobs would be paid so much more than women who actually had a high school education and were performing skilled jobs such as clerical work. Right. And that's a very different strategy than saying in order for women to have status and high pay, they have to take on the jobs that men have traditionally mm-hmm. done. These women didn't want many of the blue-collar men's jobs.
Was this strategy basically saying, we want true value for what we're doing?
Right.
Uh-huh. Is one of the reasons that they achieved so much against such great odds, and probably with a sense of not achieving anywhere near all they wanted, but still, what about this factor, or at least as a factor here, that the numbers of women in labor had increased so dramatically? I'm thinking of the effect of the war years and thereafter, that even with the return of veterans and displacement that occurred with that fact, women still, I think, were a growing force within labor and able to make their voices heard on these issues.
I think it's something that's very hard to realize today because the labor movement in the U.S. has declined so precipitously mm-hmm. since the 1970s. I think now 1 in 10 workers is organized in the private sector mm-hmm. workforce, so that's only 10%. In the period that I'm looking at, in the 40s and 50s, you had a third of the workforce organized. Mm-hmm. So the labor movement was really the largest and most powerful social movement of the day, mm-hmm. both economically and politically. Now, it's interesting, since John Sweeney has come to the helm of the AFL-CIO, he has set up a working women's department for the first time. And the head of that department, Karen Nussbaum, is fond of saying the AFL-CIO is still the largest working women's organization in the country, because even with the numbers diminished, there's still 3 million women right. in the labor movement mm-hmm. or more.
Just occurred to me, with Karen Nussbaum's observation of that many women, and that's an extraordinary number within the AFL-CIO, is there a dialogue between women in the labor movement today and I keep using the phrase gender equality to speak of the other group of feminists, the 1970s generation. Is there some dialogue established now between the two, or is it matters still as distinct as they've been in the past?
I think you do see smaller groups of researchers and professional women taking more concern with working women's mm-hmm. issues. I'm thinking of the Institute for Women's Policy Research mm-hmm. in Washington that has done a lot of research related to fair pay, the new legislation that the AFL-CIO has submitted. But you still don't see, I think, a recognition on the part of the women's movement at large mm-hmm. that class issues are actually feminist issues, that the survival of the labor movement, for example, and the ability of women to organize in the workplace and to have a voice and to press for mm-hmm. Higher wages and wage equity is a women's issue.
We could almost get very personal at this point, couldn't we, Dorothy Sue? Because I have a sense that this is more than scholarship to you. That, and I'm speculating, but maybe at the very start of your concern with this as scholar and as a woman was your sense, perhaps, that you weren't reflected, or at least people that you knew or the lives that you were familiar with were not as reflected in the 1970 school, to characterize it that way, and that had to be rectified.
I think that's definitely part of the motivation. I think when one writes any kind of history, you're trying to, in some ways, write the history that you see that hasn't been written and be true to the past, but I think there's also an autobiographical element to it, mm-hmm. And that it comes out of your own experiences mm-hmm. and needs.
Right, because I sense a degree of passion here that is laudable.
Right.
In a sense, we come now full circle, because we spoke at the an earlier point in our conversation about this is, quote, the once and future topic, and that what women began to express, well, throughout this century, but with emphasis in the 40s and 50s, speaks to us today, because it brings up the issue of class, it brings up the issue of advancing women's movement beyond just gender, but speaking to race and other components of the broader problem. And I guess this is kind of the blue sky question for you, Dorothy Sue, but we're in a world now that's fractured over globalization, in which these issues are either coming home now or bound to come home to us with great emphasis. With all that's going on domestically and internationally, and the still great campaign of inequality, what promise could there be in a broader definition of the women's movement to begin with, more dialogue within it, and sort of a recharged focus on issues that went beyond just gender equality? What could it accomplish?
I think that the women's movement of the future and the wave of the future will have to have economic inequality at its core, and that many of the concerns that the women I'm looking at and many of the tactics that they pioneered can be resurrected. If you just think about the power of the consumer and women's buying power, using their economic power for social reform, that's something that college kids are now recognizing and trying to push their universities to only purchase goods that are produced under humane conditions. This was a central issue for working class women and for women who were organizing for economic justice. So redefining the political to open it up to involvement in a whole multitude of arenas.
Dorothy Sue Cobble, I want to personally thank you, not just for the conversation, but for the scholarship, because it's really inspiring, speaking as a male, to sit here and realize that these untold chapters of our history, once we understand them and incorporate them, can not only help us appreciate the past, but actually inspire us for the present and the future, if they're correctly interpreted. So, carry on.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Dorothy Sue Cobble, professor in the School of Management and Labor Relations at Rutgers University. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed. Our technical director is John Tyler. And our production assistant is Kirsten LaCour-DeBelco. Dialogue is presented by PRI Public Radio International and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at www.ics.si.edu.